But again, we're back at Connections. This is not the Morning Sound Alternative that starts a half hour from now. I'm Roger Wendell, and my guest in studio is Anne Hine. She's Executive Director of the Colorado-Nepal Alliance, a small Denver-based nonprofit formed in 2012. She's also a data analyst at the Denver VA Medical Center and was an AAAS fellow at the U.S. Agency for International Development in the mid-90s, and she loves to travel to developing countries. And welcome to KGNU.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. As I had mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention this to anybody other than you and I, we arranged this time together well before the earthquakes in April.
We sure did.
Yeah, and things have changed sadly, dramatically since then. A lot of death, destruction. As recently as yesterday, a helicopter crashed with some U.S. Marines on a relief effort, along with some Nepalese military. A lot of lost lives, and I, you know, certainly our thoughts and prayers go out to everybody involved in all the loss, and I want to talk about that this morning. But I also, if you don't mind, would like to stick with our original theme of talking about shoes for Sherpas, because that's what attracted me to your organization first when I saw the Shoes for Sherpas box there at the Colorado Mountain Club in Golden. So if you don't mind, we'll talk about Shoes for Sherpas, and then we're going to talk at length about the relief efforts in Nepal after the earthquake. So can you first tell us who are the Sherpas? Like kind of maybe Sherpa 101.
Sure. So the Sherpas are an ethnic group in Nepal, one of maybe 80 to 90 different ethnic groups. And when we started our project, we were going to be doing some work in the Everest region, which is mostly populated by Sherpas, although there are other ethnicities there. And we came up with the name Shoes for Sherpas because we wanted to supply footwear to Nepali porters. I do want to point out that we work in other regions of Nepal, and we do distribute shoes and boots to porters who are of any ethnicity.
Okay. I noticed on your website, and we can give out that URL, and we'll give out other information as the discussion continues, though, but there are maybe a half dozen photographs of, I believe, Sherpas or porters carrying heavy loads barefoot. So is that typical that people are in the Himalaya or in Nepal barefoot doing this hard work on hard ground?
Yeah, so they probably weren't barefoot, but they were wearing very thin flip-flops, which are hard to see in the pictures.
Okay.
So they're nearly barefoot. A lot of porters wear either slide-on sandals or flip-flops, and that's because footwear is very expensive for someone who is earning a living as a porter. The average wage of a lot of rural Nepalis is $1.25 a day. A pair of hiking boots can be obtained in-country for $60. So as you can imagine, that's 2 months' salary. So it's very difficult for most porters to be able to afford decent footwear.
Tell us a little bit more about costs and how that's associated with economics and the Nepal economy before the earthquake, which is an entirely different story. But give us a sense of how maybe poorly developed the country is and how poor it is. $1.25, that sounds pretty bad to me, but where does that rank in the world? I mean, how are the Nepalese people, you know, holding up compared to the rest of the planet?
Yeah. So a statistic I heard recently that put it into perspective for me is that the GDP of Nepal is actually lower than that of Haiti. So you think of Haiti as being the least developed country in the Western Hemisphere. Nepal is less than that. They're ranked usually in the bottom 20 or 30 countries in the world, usually with other countries that are in sub-Saharan Africa.
Can I assume, though, that prior to the earthquake, nobody was starving or wanting for water or medical care or anything like that, or is that the wrong assumption?
Wrong assumption, actually. I wouldn't say in general that they have big famines like they have in Africa, but there is definitely food insecurity. We do a lot of work in a district called Dading, and just a couple months ago, it was a very sad incident of a family that had run out of the rice supplies. People there are subsistence farmers, and the monsoons came late last year, and so they had a poor rice harvest. Family had run out of the rice, and they had wheat on hand that was meant to be planted, and it had been coated with a pesticide. The family was aware of that and washed the wheat, took it to be ground, and paid the miller who ground it into flour, with actual flour, and both the miller's family and the family that had the wheat ground were all killed from the pesticides. I think 18 people died. So although you don't see famines like you do in sub-Saharan Africa, there is still food insecurity for these subsistence farmers.
And why would you focus on the dotting district in particular? Any particular reason, or just we have to start somewhere?
Yeah, so I went on my first trip to Nepal back in 2003, and a geologist here in Denver who works at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, Bob Reynolds, had told me that I should hook up with Earthbound Expeditions. He had done a trip to Tibet with them a few years earlier. So I started, I went tracking with Earthbound Expeditions back in 2003, became very good friends with my guide, Ganga, who is from the Dotting District, and the owner of the trekking agency is also from Dotting. And so when we did some more work in 2012, our new guide, Gopal, was from Dotting. So just because we had met a number of people from that district, that's why we started getting involved with it.
Okay. Can you tell us about the actual shoe collection? And again, I don't want to spend the entire time together dealing just with the shoes, because there are certain serious issues taking place in Nepal as we speak. But here's Roger Wendell at the Colorado Mountain Club office, sees the box, shoes for Sherpas, and I donate an old pair of hiking boots, in my case, maybe size 13, which probably isn't that welcome. But tell what happens. You sort the shoes, you take the shoes. What's the whole process? I drop the shoes off in a box.
Yeah, so what we really are looking for is hiking boots, because that's what helps porters the most. But we will also take running shoes that have good tread on them, especially trail shoes are great. We sort through them. We actually only go up to men's size 9, so if they're larger, we take them to either another nonprofit in the Denver area that does hiking, or we take them to homeless shelters.
And the reason for size 9, what's why the limitation?
Oh, sorry. Nepalis have very small feet. Occasionally, someone needs a size 9.5 and will bring a handful of those, but they just have a much smaller foot than an American and a much wider foot than an American. So we sort through them, make sure they have good tread, no holes, life left in the soles. And then we bring them over to Nepal. We've used air cargo and excess baggage, which is very expensive, unfortunately. And then we go to major hiking areas. So last September, we were in the Langtang region, and we distributed 1,200 pairs of both boots and shoes to people working as porters, as well as people living in the rural villages. And we can get to this later, but it's the Langtang region was devastated by the earthquake, and because we had just been there, met a lot of the villagers. They hold a special place in our heart, and we're thinking of them now.
Oh, I'm sure, and we will address that here in just a moment. I would like to talk about some of the pre-earthquake issues that came to mind when I was preparing for this, well before the earthquake, and that is, I believe you were involved in some classroom construction and maybe uniforms for students. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, in 2013, this was the first time that we did a shoe distribution in Dotting District. We went to 5 different villages, 4 in an area called Dharka, and the 5th, we went to Upper Gormu, which is the home village of the woman who owns Kathmandu Restaurant in Netherlands. Anyway, when we were at one of the schools, it was named Curry, the head of the school committee approached me and said, we really need some extra classrooms for our school. We don't have enough space. So it was basically a need that the village expressed to us, and it took us about 1.5 years, but we raised the money to build an extra classroom. It was just being completed. The roof had been placed on it. We were waiting for the concrete to be poured. My guess is it's been destroyed, but I don't know that for sure yet.
And the significance of the uniforms for the children?
Yes, uniforms are mandatory in Nepal. And at another village where we'd been doing a shoe distribution, there were a lot of children in the lowest caste that were attending this particular school. And I noticed that their clothes were literally falling apart. So we did a fundraiser last winter. A lot of very generous people donated money. And we were able to have a tailor come and measure every child at the school. That's about 70 children. And he made uniforms to measure for each child at that school.
And not to get bogged down too much in the nuts and bolts of shipping shoes over to Nepal, but my own experience in sending things to friends in Japan and Indonesia is, you know, there's customs declarations, and I know on the other end they often open up my packages to see if I'm telling the truth, as it were. But I know that wouldn't be an issue for shoes with Sherpas, but are there any concerns with their customs, that end of the deal, as to what you're actually bringing into their country?
It actually is a concern. And unfortunately, this is true in a number of countries in the world. There is some corruption in the customs department. And just to give you an example, in 2013, when we'd shipped via air cargo, the receipt that I received from the Nepali government was 1/10 of what I actually paid, which leads me to believe the other 90% went into people's pockets. I don't know that for positive, but I think that's what happened.
So how can you successfully combat that in the future, maybe after things settle down, after the relief effort has been somewhat successful? Can you guard against that in any way? I mean, how can you ensure that the shoes and the donations are going to where they're supposed to?
So the next year, 2014, we decided to take everything as excess baggage. And some of our volunteers who brought bags got through customs with no problem. My husband and I had 21 bags with us. No, excuse me, 25 bags. And we did not get through without a problem. Everything had to go back through customs. And we, again, had to pay a bribe to get them out. I don't know that it can be avoided.
Mm-hmm. But it's the, you know, and not to focus too much on this negative aspect of this, but I do know from my own travels, this is the reality in many places of the world, not just Nepal, you know.
Yeah, well, so our newest approach was we decided to do a dribble approach, and that is to get bags over one at a time. And if we hear of a Coloradoan who is going to Nepal, we ask them to bring just one bag of shoes or boots with them. And usually that has no problems getting through customs. And Mullen High School was able to take 14 bags for us last March.
Fabulous. Yeah. We're going to give out your contact information again at the end of our time together, but let's give that out now because this is such an important point. Anybody within the listening area that's going to Nepal can help out by bringing an extra bag along. What's a good way for them to do that? A phone number, website, what do you recommend?
Our phone number is 720-458-7822. Our website is www.coloradonepalalliance.org.
Okay, so I hope all my friends at the Colorado Mountain Club who are listening got that number and they're going to take some shoes with them when they go to Nepal. And on a serious note, a lot of my friends are trying to assist in Nepal, and they're giving up their climbs and treks just to go there and help. And we can talk about that as well.
And to be honest, right now, we would love it if they could take over solar lanterns. We have a big need for that, and also solar cells that can recharge cell phones.
Okay, interesting. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. The time is 9:13. We have open lines. If you have any questions about shoes for Sherpas or Nepalese relief efforts, give us a call. Nancy's standing by at the phone bank at 303-442-4242. Again, that's 303-442-4242 if you want to join the conversation. Again, my guest is Ann Hines. She's the executive director of the Colorado-Nepal Alliance and Shoes for Sherpas. So, Anne, sadly, we'll take a turn in the conversation here and talk a bit about the earthquake. I believe the biggest one took place on the 25th of April. I'm losing track of time here, last month, we'll say. How did that hit you and your organization? What's happening?
It was very difficult when we heard that there was an earthquake because the villages of Dharka were only 12 and a half miles from the epicenter. And it took many days to get information from our project coordinator. There was a loss of life in the village. 68 people were killed. Thankfully, Gopal Tamang, our coordinator, was outdoors. When the earthquake struck, he was not injured, nor was his family. However, almost every single building in Dharka is now uninhabitable. People are sheltering out in the fields. We're trying to provide tarps and tents for them. The monsoon rains are going to be coming the first or second week of June, so it's very important that we get shelter there. As of yet, the government has not been able to provide any shelter to this region, but things are getting better. Aid is starting to get into the mountain villages. And I just want to point out that Dharka is one of thousands of villages that have been impacted in Nepal. It's just, you know, one of many places that needs a lot of help from the world community.
And something I forgot to do in preparation for the program is kind of compare and contrast the size of Nepal. It's really small. I don't know what it compares to. So, in effect, the entire country, in addition to all these hundreds or maybe a few thousand villages, has been equally impacted, or that's not the case?
The numbers are about a third of the country has been impacted by the earthquake, so a very substantial portion. What makes the mountainous regions difficult is the transportation. Many of the roads were blocked by landslides. A lot of these places aren't accessible by road anyway, which means that's why they've gone in with helicopter support. And unfortunately, as you mentioned, we just found out that members of our armed services were killed trying to provide aid. And I do want to thank the U.S. government for helping Nepal. They have very few helicopters themselves, and they need assistance from other countries.
Right. And how long do you think the relief efforts are going to take place, or how long do you anticipate it being required to get all of these villages back on their feet? Are we looking at years?
We're looking at years, at least 5 years, perhaps longer. They're estimating that 600,000 structures have been made unusable.
600,000.
They're either fully collapsed or they're so badly damaged that they can't be used because of worry that another aftershock will bring them down.
And that brings to mind maybe construction standards. I don't know if you can talk about that, if you know much about maybe the construction of these 600,000 different structures and if things are going to change as a result of this particular earthquake.
So what's typical in the mountain villages is a brick and mud mortar technique. So they'll take up field stones out of the hillside and they'll lay them in rows and use mud mortar between the rows, and then they'll have wooden door jambs and window jambs. And the walls are usually quite thick, about maybe a foot thick, but the pictures we've seen, most of them did not survive that were near the epicenter. We have a very good friend, Mingma Sherpa, who lives in Kumjung, which is above Namche Bazaar. He had damage to his house after the first earthquake. But the second earthquake was much closer, and he said that all the homes in Kumjung collapsed. So Nepal is very prone to earthquakes. We expect them to happen again, and we do fear that if they use their traditional building techniques, that they're going to fall down again.
So is there any emphasis, or maybe if I could say it politely, pressure to get them to change these construction techniques at this time? I know money's a huge issue, but if we're going to do anything, are we going to do it right?
Exactly. So what's required is a lot of capacity building. Quite frankly, the builders in all of these rural areas don't know any other way to build. Right now, Engineers Without Borders USA is looking at this issue. They're looking at designs for different structures. I believe they're going to attempt to do a fact-finding mission to see some of the alternative building techniques that had been used in country, how did they withstand these earthquakes, to try to make some decisions as to what building techniques could be used. But then you've got the huge issue of propagating these building techniques to this very large dispersed population of builders. So it's something that's going to take years. One of my fears is that because of the monsoon rains, they affect all of Nepal, that people are going to start rebuilding this fall in preparation for next year's monsoons, and that people may not have learned new building techniques yet by this fall. So it's something that worries me greatly, trying to get technical assistance there as quickly as possible.
You mentioned a moment ago 600,000 structures lost in Nepal because of the earthquake. How are all of these people, the survivors, living now? I'm assuming they're in tents. If you could describe that situation.
Many are not in tents. So building techniques vary in different parts of the country. In some parts of the country, they have corrugated tin roofs. And for the most part, those survived the quake. So those families are able to make a temporary shelter with some panels, tin panels. Unfortunately, in the Dadong district where we work, a common technique is a wood frame with pieces of slate tile on it. And so all of those roofs really aren't able to be reused. They were intact, or parts of them were intact, but they're incredibly heavy, and they're not good for a temporary shelter. So one of the things the Colorado Nepal Alliance has been working on is to get tarps and tents to these villages. It's very difficult. We're working right now on getting some tarps imported from India. And as you might imagine, the paperwork is crazy what they're requiring for us to get them across the border, because they are worried that we're not giving them away, that we're going to sell them for a markup, even though we're a nonprofit and we're delivering them to another nonprofit in Nepal.
So you're an NGO, an official nonprofit. How do you prove that to like a Nepalese official?
Well,
is there like a world register of nonprofit NGOs?
Not that I'm aware of. It's all done by a series of letters and stamps. And as you might imagine, it's very hard to get people to find a scanner right now and to be able to send us scans of their signatures. It's something that we're working on at the moment, and some larger NGOs are helping us with this.
Isn't it amazing? Bureaucracy everywhere, even in this special time of need. Well, it's astonishing.
Well, what was amazing to me is that the earthquake hit on a Saturday, and it wasn't until the following Friday that the Nepalese government said that tarps and tents could come into the country duty-free.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
and that brings me back to a question I missed earlier. Initially, when the earthquake took place, you mentioned it took you a while just to find out, you know, the condition of your staff and his housing and that kind of thing. How are you hearing from people there as we speak? Are regular phones working, or is this all sat phone, or what's happening?
So we're able to, the cell phone networks are up, and we work with Rajan Simkata, who owns Earthbound Expeditions, and he's my link in Nepal. Sometimes I'm able to reach Gopal on his cell phone, but right now he's in the village and there is no way to recharge his cell phone. So a lot of it is just word of mouth. If someone is traveling out of the village, messages are just passed until someone can reach either someone with a charged cell phone or a landline, and then they call back into Kathmandu. So right now it's very difficult to get to communicate in the villages.
As is always the case in disasters that, you know, I've paid attention to, the outbreak of disease is a huge, huge problem, and you're nodding your head in agreement. Yeah. What's going on? Is there cholera or any of those kind of concerns in Nepal as we speak?
So I have not yet heard that there's been an outbreak of cholera, but health organizations are very worried about that. Most people's latrines were destroyed in this earthquake. And again, I'm speaking to people that are living in these rural villages.
And these would be traditional, I mean, what we'd be accustomed to on a farm here or in the forest, just a latrine, an outdoor.
Yes, an outdoor facility, but they usually would have a small structure built around it, again, out of stone and mud mortar. And so most latrines have been destroyed. The other thing that I've been reading about is that they're worried about pneumonia with the onset of the monsoons and people not having adequate shelter. So, and the other thing I want to point out is our organization started a health capacity survey last fall, documenting what health services were available in this northern part of the Dading district and how long it takes people to walk from one village to where the health services exist. And the government-run health posts have very few medications available. And the staff has very little training, just like a year and a half post-high school.
Right.
You know, not even the equivalent of a nurse. So we're really worried about if disease does set in, people getting adequate care.
Okay. 9:23 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My in-studio guest this morning is Ann Hines. She's executive director of the Colorado-Nepal Alliance, a small Denver-based nonprofit formed in 2012, and they're working on the Nepalese relief effort as we speak after the horrendous earthquakes of April and then some aftershocks as recently as, I think, Tuesday of this week. And I'm wondering, Anne, maybe a bit of an unfair question, but I believe Nepal had a huge earthquake in 1925, maybe.
1934 is the one I'm aware of.
I wasn't close, but did we or they learn much from that particular earthquake? And were the conditions similar, same amount of destruction, death? But did they improve after that at all?
To be honest, I don't know anything about that earthquake except that it was very large.
Okay, fair enough. Another question, you mentioned these temporary shelters just a few moments ago and the monsoons that are coming, but my assumption would be that the winters would be pretty harsh in Nepal. It's all high elevation, I'm guessing, maybe averaging around 10,000 feet or whatever it is in these different villages. How serious is winter going to be if you're living in a tent or a corrugated roofed little temporary shelter?
So it really depends on where you are in Nepal. The village in Kumjung, which is in the Everest region, is, I believe, at 12,000 feet. However, the villages in the hill area are more in the 4,000 to 6,000 foot range.
A little bit lower than I would have thought.
Exactly. Yeah. So in the summertime, it's incredibly hot there. In the wintertime, the water does not tend to freeze, but it's still very chilly. It'll get into the low 40s overnight. So you'll see photographs of people wearing hats and down coats. So we're worried about that, too.
But apparently then the monsoon season is the most urgent, most serious aspect of the change in weather.
Exactly. We've got 3 to maybe 4 weeks tops before it hits. We have found a shelter that's available in-country, being made by an in-country NGO that has, according to their website, roots in Pueblo, Colorado. It's called Portal Shelters. And they use U-shaped pieces of rebar, and then they put strips of tin to form a Quonset hut. And then the family would use local materials to form either end of the shelter. It's something we're looking at. They're only $100 a piece. So if people want to help, if you send $100, that can buy a portal shelter, which will shelter a family in the interim. It's not a good long-term shelter, but it will keep them dry during the monsoons. It will also keep their food dry during the monsoons, which is very important.
Very good to know. And again, we'll give out that contact information again here in just a few moments at the conclusion of our time together. But before that, I was wondering if you could take some time to tell us a little bit about Sarah Wilson and her ride.
Yes, Sarah Wilson is a wonderful young woman who approached us, and she is going to be riding from Denver, Colorado, all the way up to Anchorage, Alaska. She leaves on May 31st, and she has decided to raise money for the Colorado-Nepal Alliance. And if you go to our website, coloradonepalalliance.org, there are links to where you can sponsor Sarah to ride all the way between Denver and Anchorage. And again, 100% of what she raises is going to Colorado-Nepal Alliance. And I do want to point out that we are an all-volunteer organization, so we have almost no overhead. So when people are donating to us, really the money is going straight over to Nepal.
In addition to the donations, are you or have you taken volunteers along to Nepal to assist maybe with, I know prior to the earthquake it wouldn't have been construction, but would that be the case here in the near future?
Yes.
If I wanted to go to Nepal with your organization, I could come along at my own expense. Yeah. So.
We have had a couple volunteers in the past, and we would be definitely willing to talk to people about it. Again, you're correct, they would have to pay their own way over. And it's something we would want to talk to them about. Conditions are not easy right now in Nepal, and they would need to seriously consider wanting to go with us.
So you do have plans for some immediate trips here in the near future?
Yes, I'm waiting for the dust to settle. My best guess is I'll be going in the early fall. Right now, I think I would be more in the way. They would worry about me quite a bit and spend too much time worrying about my comfort and my having enough food, and I would prefer them not to be worrying about me.
But your contact, and I apologize, I can't pronounce his name, but
Gopal Tamang.
Yeah, he's able to, his family is secure enough, and he's secure enough at this point to be able to handle your organization's affairs on that end.
Actually, his family is not yet secure. I mean, he has to rebuild like everybody does. But Gopal and his father are big supporters of their community. They're natural born leaders, and they're the perfect people to help Dharka with the rebuilding efforts.
And how about the shoe effort? Any less emphasis on shoes at this point because of the relief effort?
Exactly. We are still collecting hiking boots. If you guys have some wonderful trail shoes, keep them in your basement for now. We would love to have them, but it might be a couple years before we start bringing shoes over. We spent over $5,000 shipping last time, and we would really like that money to go towards shelters right now.
And I wanted to mention, in addition to the Colorado Mountain Club having collected shoes on your behalf, there are at least another dozen locations in the Denver area that
were
doing the same, and that information is available on your website.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're so short of time, but I appreciate you having appeared today. Maybe you could take this opportunity to, again, remind folks how they can help, what would be the most effective help at this time, where they can learn more about the organization.
The most effective help right now is cash donations, or if you are traveling to Nepal, we would love to have you take over some solar lanterns or rechargeable systems. Our website is www.coloradonepalalliance.org. Phone number is 720-458-7822. We would love you to join us in helping to rebuild Nepal.
Fantastic. Well, Ann Hines, thank you so much for coming to KGNU this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, keep up the great work. You've been listening to Connections, and that was my guest, Ann Hines. She's Executive Director of the Colorado-Nepal Alliance. I want to give a big thanks to Nancy for running things behind the scenes this morning, and I want to thank you, the listener member, for your support of this community resource, this gem, as it were, KGNU Denver, KGUN Boulder. I'm Roger Wendell. Up next is Meredith with the Morning Sound Alternative. Have a great day.